estimation. And he's even looked into what many feel are the remote possibilities of an Arthur Bremer conspiracy. Mr. Fensterwell would be here. He was one of the Watergate attorneys early on. He's now James Earl Ray's attorney, and we'll talk of that case. Morton Sabell here will be later on as well. He was the co-defendant with Julius and Ethel Rosenberg in that case. So that's our lineup, and we shall begin in a moment with the junior senator. I don't know if it's like that, meeting with, thanks Lou for the Texas music there, I'm sure. See, he's trying to project himself into a national image and you play. Please welcome to Panorama, one of the most active attorneys in the country, active in many areas, one of which is political conspiracies. He and a couple of others in this country have been pursuing the conspiracy and the assassination of John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King, even the attempt against George Wallace. He was also the man who defended and still does defend James McCord and the Watergate cover-up and the initial Watergate trial itself. He is Bud Fensterwell. Nice to see you.
Always good to see you.
Nice to be here.
Let me ask you this, when it came, were you shocked by the Hunt memo that was released in the trial? Were you surprised at that?
No, I wasn't surprised at all because I've known about it for some time and I thought it was just a question of time before it came out.
Does that mean other attorneys in that case had known about it for some time or just you?
Well, there were several others that I know who did know about it.
But it was obvious that Mr. Bittman knew about it. I mean, this was the origin of it. Do you think then that he will have to be indicted for having given wrong information?
Well, it seems to me he's in a very tough spot at the moment. There are a number of people who have made deals with the special prosecutor. I know that Mr. Caulfield, for example, made a deal early on. There are a number of them who have made deals that they won't be prosecuted, and I have no idea if Mr. Bittman falls in that class or not.
But don't those who make deals give something in return?
They normally do, but in the case of Mr. Caulfield, I haven't seen him really give a great deal in return. Mr. Gray, who is the head of the FBI, has never been indicted. He admitted to destroying evidence and perjuring under other things.
Is it possible that Mr. Gray might yet be indicted? Or is that too far down the road?
I think it's very unlikely because I think the special prosecutor is trying to wind down his operation and close it up. I think for pretty obvious political reasons.
One more question. Did Mr. McCord know about the memo? And did the other defendants know about the memo when it was written?
I believe at the time it was written that everybody except McCord knew. And McCord was sort of a
black sheep
in this group. And he really didn't communicate with any of these other people very regularly. But I think that the Cubans knew about it. And I would suspect Liddy did, but I'm not sure. But McCord knew about it at least 18 months ago because he told me about it.
He told you that Hunt had written a memo?
That's correct. The fact is, he testified, I think, in March of 73 to that effect, although at that time nobody could come up with a copy of it, but he seemed confident that a copy would show up at some time.
Yes, the fact of the memo was not the startling, it was the sudden appearance of it.
And the Xerox machine has changed a lot of things in life.
And the tape recorder.
Only those Xerox machines without accompanying shredders. Anyway, let me move on, because you are actively involved in another case that is before the American public, and that is the one regarding James Earl Ray. I assume that you were in Tennessee.
We were there for 2.5 weeks, and I think we had the longest habeas corpus hearing in history, and the first one in which the right to discovery was ever granted. And a good part of our case was built out of material we discovered from the prosecutor's files just immediately before the hearing.
Now, what is the status? Is the judge considering it? You have asked for, James Earl Ray has asked for a new trial.
Well, what he's really asked for is a trial. He was never tried. He pled guilty, and he would like to withdraw his guilty plea and stand trial. And at the moment, it's before the judge, and because of the size of the record and some other pleadings, it will probably be the middle of January before he decides it.
Now, there was some startling testimony offered during your hearing before that judge, one in which, if the evidence is indeed valid, there was a conspiracy regarding Martin Luther King Jr. Do you have any doubts that there was a conspiracy?
Well, I have no doubts whatever, and actually, if we can get a trial for Ray, I have the greatest confidence that it'll be a very short trial, that he'll be acquitted, and then it will be up to the state of Tennessee and to the Justice Department to come forth with those that did.
What you're saying is not only would he be acquitted, he was never a member of the conspiracy?
I don't believe so. Now, one thing I want to be cautious here, because I don't want to mislead you, it has never been his burden to prove that he didn't shoot Dr. King. It's the burden of the state to prove that he did. There's a great deal of information that he has, which he's never divulged to us or to anybody else.
The information verbally or
never divulged it in any way, evidence with respect to the killing, and he has, a very valid reason for doing it. He says that if he does, he's a dead man. And knowing prisons fairly well, I think that's a very logical position for him to take.
Even though the security that is, there's unbelievable security regarding him, is there not?
Well, he has been held in solitary confinement for 4 out of the last 5 years, and why he's not stark raving mad, I don't know.
Then if he's in solitary confinement, why couldn't he say what he needed to say and get off, if that's what you're...
Well, his position is that if he gets off, he's not going to live very long.
Oh, if he gets off, if he's allowed to go outside, he's a dead man.
His position is that he was not involved in it. The state can't prove that he was. He'll be tried, hopefully, and will be acquitted without, in effect, blabbing on those responsible. And it's very difficult to argue with that position because I think it's a very realistic one.
Why, then, can he say to you that he pled guilty?
Well,
he didn't feel he committed.
Well, he has told us in great length, and this came out in this long hearing in Tennessee, he was kept in the most unbelievable circumstances for 8 months before the guilty plea you can imagine. There were closed-circuit televisions on him 24 hours a day. The lights were never shut off. The window in his cell had a steel plate over. He didn't see the light of day for 8 months. And his lawyers jockeyed him around. He was just in an impossible position.
Well, why would his lawyers jockey him around? I mean, there were some pretty important names who were his attorneys at that time, and they came with some strong credentials. And what you're saying was that his attorneys treated him to such an extent that they shouldn't even be practicing the law.
Well, you have to distinguish in two groups of lawyers, but the first lawyer he had was Art Haynes of Birmingham, who was going to trial, had no intentions of pleading him guilty. The second one was Percy Foreman of Houston, who somehow persuaded himself that he shouldn't go to trial and then persuaded Ray. But the real problem is that from the very outset, Ray gave up all his rights by agreeing to certain literary contracts involving William Bradford Huey and others, so that instead of his lawyers working for Ray, they were working for those who were writing articles and planning movies and things. And there's just a terrible conflict of interest there.
Mm-hmm. Who do you think was behind this conspiracy?
If we knew that, we could save ourselves a great deal of trouble. I don't know. I do know that the Department of Justice has got enough information so that if they were willing to sit down with us and talk sensibly, it could probably be solved in short order.
Why wouldn't they? I mean, what you're saying is that the government has been absolutely unresponsive to your pleas, to your appeals, that you've had to go to the judge, and it's only the judge that's allowed you to have this hearing.
The federal government is in a very, very unenviable position going back a number of years, I think primarily to the killing of John Kennedy, because in that particular case, which was handled almost entirely by the federal government, the government no doubt knows who killed John Kennedy. They've got the crucial information locked up in the archives to the year 2039. They have a massive investigation, the key parts of which are not going to be revealed.
Excuse me, who killed John?
Have I jumped too far for you?
Well,
what he's saying is, and a lot of say is that that Finster wall, there's that nut again trying to say that there was a conspiracy involved with John Kennedy. Since the John Kennedy assassination, the government has tried, in effect, keep secret all information regarding his killing, his brother's killing, Martin Luther King's killing, and all those big, huge political assassinations that the country of course, that the country would be very, very much interested in.
Unfortunately, having set the one precedent and there being some big muddy footprints between some of these killings, I think that they've boxed themselves in. I think if the government could find some way of opening the files and clearing the air on this, they would certainly like to do so. I don't think that they think this is a very helpful situation we're in. I don't get that feeling at all.
But how about your own reputation? I mean, you are thought of, and a couple of others, as scurrying around this country for 10 years at least, trying to drum up support for these conspiratorial theories that you and a couple of others have. And so far, you haven't been able to do anything yet. And so all you're doing is just making trouble.
Well, you have to have a tough hide if you're going to be in this business, because you're not terribly popular. But we have made some progress. I think we've made progress in the Ray case. I think progress is being made in the Robert Kennedy case. There was a hearing in Los Angeles not too long ago, which got very little publicity, which I think rather conclusively showed, no matter what else was involved there, that Sirhan Sirhan could not have fired the shots that killed Robert Kennedy.
Now, do you defend him?
No, I do not. I have nothing to do with the case. But here again, the FBI collected 10 volumes of material.
He couldn't have shot him, and I'm trying to think back, but he was wrestled to the ground by Rosie Grier
and
Rayford Johnson with his gun and everything there.
All right. There's no question that Sirhan was there. He was firing his gun. He wounded a number of people. But Los Angeles County has got one of the outstanding pathologists in the country as their coroner, and he did the autopsy along with four other well-renowned people from around the country. And they concluded that Robert Kennedy was hit by 3 bullets. All were fired from behind and below and at a maximum range of 6 inches. The fatal bullet hit him behind the right ear at between 1 and 3 inches, they could tell from the powder burns. Now, Sirhan was in front of Robert Kennedy. Above him, he was standing on a tray rack. And a number of feet away, even with an outstretched hand. So just taking the physical evidence, Sirhan could not have been the one that shot Robert Kennedy, even though he was firing a gun like mad and didn't wound a number.
But with the reporters clustered around Robert Kennedy as they were leaving that ballroom, can you imagine somebody 3 inches from Robert Kennedy shooting a gun and the reporters who were against him like that not seeing it?
Well, there happened to be a man who I shall leave unnamed for the safety of this television station, who actually had Robert Kennedy by the right elbow, who was armed, who was knocked to the floor, who did draw his gun, and there's a big open question as to whether he fired it or he didn't. If he did, he was firing back at Sirhan, which would be perfectly natural. That's what he was there for. This man was never called as a witness. The coroner was not allowed to testify. The ballistics in the case were done on another gun, not Sirhan's gun, and the gun that did the ballistics on was destroyed. You find all these cases are not tried like regular criminal cases or murder cases. The average murder case in Washington, just the average street crime, would be handled in a much more thorough and scientific fashion than all these cases are.
What you're implying to me, Bud, is that there is no case in which there is no doubt about the killing of one person by another, that you can't tie the strings together in murder cases. They're always, that to me was an open and shut case. He was the man, he was the gun, they knew he was fired, they grabbed him, they held him. And now you're saying that he could not have fired the fatal shots that killed Robert Kennedy.
Well, all I'm saying is the physical evidence proves that he couldn't.
But
if anybody were willing to sit down and look at the evidence and do something with it, they would have to not necessarily reopen the case or indict anybody else. If I'm correct on the facts, I don't believe anybody else would be indicted at trial. But I do think that the truth about it, I think the coroner should testify, I think the man that did the ballistics should testify. I think the facts as to how he died, as many other murder cases, should be made public. Whether it proves anything.
Let me take one other, and that's a George Wallace.
Yes.
Have you been involved in that at all?
Yes, I have, as you would probably suspect.
Because George Wallace himself says he does not think it was the work of one man, i.e. Arthur Brimmer.
Well, he's correct.
Who else was involved?
I don't know.
I thought he denied saying that.
No, he's not denied that.
He did not deny saying that there was more than one man.
George Wallace has an obsession with this. By that I mean an obsession good, not an obsession bad. But he is convinced that the people behind his murder have never been brought to book. And I think he's correct in that. If anybody did the investigation in Milwaukee, they would find a number of things out about Brimmer that would lead you to believe that he was financed and directed by someone.
But there was an investigation in Milwaukee, and FBI agents apparently combed that area. Now, they never came up with it, or if they did, they never reported it to the prosecutors in that case, did they?
Well, you see, the federal government took control of the case, and then they threw it back to the Prince George's County officials, and the prosecution had to go on what evidence was given to them. But Brimmer's apartment, for example, was entered by the FBI, who left, a number of reporters came in and removed all sorts of things, and then the FBI came back. Now, what kind of way is this for the FBI to behave? I mean, why wouldn't they seal the apartment off and see what's in it?
Was it during that time, and correct me if I'm wrong, but Howard Hunt went out to look in that apartment?
Well, Howard Hunt didn't go.
He didn't
go. He was asked by Chuck Colson, apparently on the directions of the president, to go out and enter the apartment before the FBI got there. And nobody's quite clear, one, why the president wanted him to do it, whether he was going to put something in the apartment, take something out. But in any event, he couldn't get there in time to do it.
Now I remember what the governor denied. He denied that he had said that anyone in the plumbers was involved in it. That's what he denied. He didn't want to make that impression.
Well, I think he would have to, because I don't think he has any evidence. Yeah. The only thing that's interesting, though, in addition to the Hunt business, is the fact that Donald Segretti had spent a great deal of time in Milwaukee just before Brimmer took off on his trip, and Brimmer took off with $1,000 in cash that he got from somebody.
You cannot
make that jump, but the evidence proves
except
it.
That there was a primary in Wisconsin, wasn't there?
There was a primary.
Which is why Segretti would be in Wisconsin.
I presume that that's true, but the question is, where did the $1,000 that Brimmer used for his travels come from? I've talked with Brimmer's mother and his father, and I know that at the time he left, he didn't have a dime. He got it from somewhere because he tried to borrow money from his mother.
Have you been able, Bud, just talking about the Martin Luther King, the two Kennedys, and Governor Wallace, can you draw a connection?
I cannot. And I think anybody that attempts to do so is on very, very thin ice. I think until we get more of the facts with respect to each of these cases, to attempt to do this is very, very risky. Because, you know,
is that where you and others who have pursued the conspiratorial theories differ? Because I know some who have tried to draw the line among all those acts.
Well, I belong to a rather small group. You could say we have our annual meetings in a telephone booth. Actually, about 30 or 40 people. They're doctors, lawyers, professors, writers. We deal to the extent that we can in facts and do not try to deal in any type of theories or hypotheses or anything of that type. There are a lot of people that do that. I personally would discourage them if I could, but I can't, because I think it makes it more difficult to solve any of these cases if you get outside of the factual realm and into theory.
May I ask you this? Much of this was done when J. Edgar Hoover was the director of the FBI. Now, he's dead, and Clarence Kelly is the director. If I was an inquisitive law enforcement officer, the head of the FBI, and I had people like you continually questioning those investigations, as a director of the FBI, would go into those files and see for myself if there is any doubt. Now, don't you think Mr. Kelly has done something like that?
I would seriously doubt it. Mr. Kelly is a fine man. I've known him for some years. I knew him when he was in Kansas City. I don't believe in the first place that the FBI files would be the place to go, because the FBI was deeply involved with Lee Harvey Oswald. The investigation that they made was very limited in ways similar to the Watergate. and Watergate, they limited their investigation very narrowly in many areas. In the Warren Commission hearings, they limited their investigations. I don't think you'll find the answers there. I think if you're going to find them, you'll have to go to other people's files. I would start with the CIA, and no one's ever going to be able to do that.
One more question, then we have to pause. Who can get into the archives? Who has a pass?
Into the secret material?
Yes.
The only people I know is one man named Marion Johnson, who's been the sort of the... He's not the archivist of the United States. He's the archivist for these materials and the President of the United States. Those would be the only two people I would know.
One quickie. You've been involved in all of these things you say. Have you ever had any threats against your life?
None whatever. That's one of the great... some people say should be a great disappointment, because if we were getting anywhere, that ought to be the natural consequence, but I have not.
We're going to pause and continue. A gentleman will be joining us, along with Bud. He remembers him in that case, I am sure. And he has charged wrongdoing on the part of the government and others involved in his case. He is Morton Sobel, who was at trial along with the Rosenbergs in that famous case. They will be here. Thanks, Bonnie, for coming by. Appreciate it.
Good to be here.
Just got to go downtown. We'll be back in a minute. Here's a co-defendant with the Rosenbergs, and he was convicted of conspiracy to commit espionage. He served 18 years in prison and was released, I think, in 1970?
1969.
He has written his book, On Doing Time, not only the trial itself, but the last 20-some years of his life. Nice to be with us.
I'm glad to be here.
Mr. Fensterwald talks about you better go to the CIA, and they're the people who know a lot about a lot of things, and you'll never find out anything from them. I know the CIA plays a part in your trial too, doesn't it?
I don't believe so. I believe it was the FBI primarily, even though it involved supposedly the Soviet Union, that is, the secrets were supposed to have been transmitted to the Soviet Union. I never heard of the CIA having played any part, but of course it wouldn't surprise me if they did.
This stance, though, that Mr. Fensterwald talks about the federal government in many of these matters, is that a similar one to the one taken regarding you or not?
We'll have to be more precise.
Well, in a way, are you upset at the government? I mean, did they commit wrongdoing in your case? I mean, there's a great renaissance to the fact that not only you, but the Rosenbergs themselves got, in effect, the shaft.
Did they commit wrongdoing? Recently, there was a TV program on in which one of the FBI agents, to my mind, very stupidly told the interviewer, the pressure from Washington, he said, was tremendous. We had to find the spy. They knew there was a spy. I don't know how they knew there was a spy, but they had to find the spy. Well, you know that when people are under pressure to find the spy or the spies, what will happen? And they got the message.
I saw that documentary, and I've seen what you have said, and in effect, you were saying you were the victim of the times.
More than the victim of the times. The government staged this trial primarily for one reason, in order to heat up the Cold War. So while I was a victim of the times, the trial was also staged to create the times as well. There was a
fed on itself.
Yes,
so
it fed on itself.
Great political pressure is what you're talking about.
Right. There was political pressure from Washington. It went down through the FBI to the U.S. Attorney's Office. And you might say there was a conspiracy, but there was a conspiracy in the sense that a lot of people got around the table and conspired. But everyone knew the part he had to play. The prosecutor knew that he had to convict, even if he had to commit perjury, get his witnesses to commit perjury. The judge, for instance, knew that he had to make sure there was a conviction, even if the ordinary rules that govern courtroom procedure were overlooked. The Court of Appeals knew that when the appeal came up, they had to overlook the niceties of law. The Supreme Court knew that just as well. It had never happened before that the Supreme Court denied certiorari in such an important case where the lives of people were at stake. But at that time, the Supreme Court knew that it could not grant certiorari because that would have stretched the case out just a little too long. The pressure was mounting internationally, and they knew that by the time they handed down their decision, which would have taken, say, about 9 months, it would have been impossible to execute the rules.
When did it get to the Supreme Court?
It got to the Supreme Court the first time in 1952, and then it got to them the last time on a 2255 in June of 1953, and they were reconvened. Another interesting thing, they were reconvened. It only happened once before in history, but they had reconvened from a summer recess in order to, in effect, remove the stay that Douglas had granted at that time. The truth of the matter is that, as any lawyer should know, the Supreme Court did not have the power to vacate Douglas's stay. And I'm not saying it on my own. The Columbia Law Review, in a year or two later, published an anonymous article. It's significant in these times that the article was anonymous, in which the vacating of Douglas's stay was examined in great detail, and there was no power that the Supreme Court had to do that, and I think you probably know that.
It doesn't surprise me, because at the same time this was going on, I was trying to defend some of the old China hands against the pro-communist charge, and I had a batting average of 0-0-0. I lost every case.
But what Mr. Sobel is talking of is, if not a conspiracy, an awareness of everyone down through the government apparatus. I'm always worried about that, because somebody along the way has, to me, would say, now wait a minute. I mean, you're talking of many, many people. You're talking of judges, you're talking of prosecutors, you're talking other public officials. And they're all coming, what you're doing is they're all nodding their heads. Right, Rosenberg and Sobel, right, sure, right. Okay, right.
But you must remember the motivation. At this time, everybody was scared of communism. Communism, the international conspiracy, ready to jump on us. These people who acted in this fashion were genuinely motivated. They were genuinely, they had convinced themselves, or they had been convinced, that this was for the good of the country. And as the burglars of Watergate were convinced that what they were doing was for the good of the country, all these judges, prosecutors, and everyone down the line convinced themselves that the normal laws, the normal procedures could be bypassed, could be overlooked, if it was for the good of the country.
You said the second time was 55. Had not the McCarthy power worn off by 55, or was beginning to
wear? 53, I'm sorry. The last time
it was 50.
But even so, I don't think you're right in saying that McCarthy is, and I say, hit its peak
in 55.
That would be the peak. And 57 was already a slight decline. But 55, I think, was the peak.
But could you draw a possible theory that the McCarthy era? Well, I'm going to save the question, unless, you know, 1 second. We'll be back in a moment. And I can rephrase it the way I want to. After this message from Coke. And investigated many items in various assassinations. He is just an activist when it comes to the law. He gets himself into some unbelievable cases. And Morton Sobel, who is the author of this book, On Doing Time, the story not only of his trial with the Rosenbergs, but the question of his last two decades, 18 years of which he spent in prison. Is there a reason? Let me follow up my point briefly here. It doesn't concern Mr. Sobel. The feeling of the McCarthy era, the McCarthyism, that pervasive word, is it logical then to have in this country, after McCarthyism, the political assassinations that we did? Is there not necessarily a physical tie-in, but at least an emotional one of a feeling in the country?
My guess on that, and it's just purely a guess, is that there is not. I think the one thing that people refuse to recognize in this country is that historically, method of changing power in every country in the world throughout history, most popular method has been assassination. I had one of my kids go and look at the Roman emperors and the czars and the French emperors, and you'd be amazed at the percentage of them that were killed violently one way or the other. In this country, we think we're above it. We always talk about the banana republics. When one of our presidents or other leaders gets killed, it's always a lone nut. Somehow we think we're above everybody else. Well, there is the same desire in this country to change power. It can be done in this country and covered up in such a way to make it look as though you have a lone nut every time you have a man with a smoking gun left at the scene. But somehow this just doesn't, in my mind, relate back to McCarthyism. I just don't see any time.
Let me go into this with Mr. Sobel. Do you have, how much of a misgiving do you have about your defense and how it was carried out? Mr. Fenstewell talks about some of the defenses that he's been involved in.
Well, the defense was bad. It was so bad it was practically non-existent. Just take one example. When the government introduced this exhibit of the atom bomb, Exhibit 8, which was the secret of the atom bomb, which Greengrass was supposed to have given to Rosenberg,
yes.
Et cetera, et cetera.
Well, half of a card or something?
No, that's something else. Manuel Bloch, the lawyer of the Rosenbergs, got up and made a motion that it be impounded. The theory under which he made this motion was perhaps it hadn't fallen into the hands of the Russians. He was a patriot, and he didn't want to see the thing in public where the Russians now could see it. Of course, what this did, in effect, was to hide it so that between that time and 1966, nobody could see it and could see what a farce the whole thing was. Now, I'm sure he genuinely thought this was the secret of the atom bomb, but he was a lawyer, and he wasn't a physicist, and he wasn't really qualified to make any evaluation.
But this wasn't an active cover-up on his...
No, this was not an active cover. Why did he do this? All I can say is he was so frightened of the whole thing. He was as much a victim of the times as the defendants were. And he felt that he was being identified with the defendants too much in the eyes of the jury. And he wanted to show the jury that he was a patriot. We'll put that in quotation marks. And in doing so, of course, he shortchanged his defendants. There are many, many other instances where the lawyers refused to make a really fighting defense.
Those were judgments. They weren't trying
right.
to hide evidence.
No.
They weren't trying to cover up anything.
No, our lawyers, I don't believe, our lawyers, I never felt that our lawyers, I never accused them of bad faith. They were genuinely in our corner, but they were frightened. And the times, for instance, when a judge told one of the lawyers, well, that's enough questioning. Well, any lawyer knows when a judge tells a lawyer to stop questioning along a certain line, the lawyer goes around, makes a left play, makes a right play. You know, he tries to get the thing out. Here is Bloch questioning Bentley, the spy queen, on how much money she had made on this thing. And she said, well, I can't remember. So he tries to refresh her memory. And the judge tells him, that's enough, that's not pertinent. And Bloch just shuts up. Well, to me it was amazing. I mean, this was very pertinent. How much money had she been making going around lecturing? And yet when the judge told told Bloch to shut up, Bloch shut up. Well, no lawyer in his right mind who was not afraid would have shut up at that point, but yet these lawyers did. So if I, in this book, criticize the lawyers, it is not in any malevolent sense. I sympathize with their position. This trial called for heroes.
But isn't it a timid profession all around?
Well, look at some of the lawyers today.
Well,
look at Kunstler, Bill Kunstler. He's not very timid. And look at Mark Lane at the Wounded Knee trial.
But out of 250,000, how many are there?
Right. You're very right.
Unfortunately, we have to quit. I thank you very much, Morton Sobel, for being here. His book is Undoing Time. I assume that although you talk of justice and that the need for justice, not only in your case but throughout. You're calling for the reopening of your trial or not?
Of course. I'm calling for the reopening of, for the opening of the FBI files, because if you open up the FBI files, you will see how the perjured witnesses were able to perjure themselves.
You're not holding your breath, are you?
No.
Right. I didn't think so. Bud, thank you very much.
A pleasure, though.
Always good to talk to you. You're marvelous, marvelous character when it comes to investigations and... I assume you're not quitting in any of these areas.
Well, I practice law for a living. We do this as a hobby, so I think we'll keep it up.
Okay. We'll be back in a moment. Thank you.
Godfrey Cambridge, and I'm fit and pretty, and I dig it because I know that using a packet of Sweet Low instead of 2 teaspoons of sugar saves 30 calories. Now multiply that by 3 times a day. 365 days a year. Sweet Low saves 32,850 calories. Isn't it about time you tried Sweet Low? Think about it.
Hello, I'm Art Scheinbaum, president of Mel Art Keepsake Corner, bringing you a beautiful pair of diamond-pierced earrings. Each diamond set in delicately carved 14-karat gold setting and totaling 1/3 of a carat. Beautiful, magnificent, fiery diamonds. I invite you into our stores to see them. That's Mel Art Keepsake Corner.
The new Weave, with tasty rock and roll for everybody.
Elementary, my dear Watson. Pound cakes are like wines. Each one has its own signature. Now, this one is a package mix, and this darker one is a well-known frozen pound cake.
But this one helps.
Ah, yes. The golden color, the natural-looking texture. One would think it was homemade, but since we know it is not, it could only come from one other place.
Of course. Where?
Cleveland.
Of course. Stouffer's. Cleveland.
Last week, I had some time to kill, so I stopped in a Dollar General store. It's the first time I'd been in the store in quite a while, and I'd honestly forgotten how low Dollar General prices are. Well, as I walked through the store, a couple of things caught my eye. Like this sweatshirt for my son, a sweatshirt for my wife, and this flannel shirt for me. All came to about $5. Next time you're near a Dollar General store, drop on in. It's like meeting an old friend, especially with today's prices.
With over 600 stores, there's one near you.
Tomorrow in Panorama, we will be dealing with how to economically save when it comes to food. Now that's rather difficult these days, but among our guests will be Dr. Neil Solomon. You know him from the state of Maryland. He is the chief hygienist there, among other things. Grace Firth will be here, Jane Chapman from the Leland Street Food Co-op, and we'll be discussing all the nutritious ways, economical ways to eat these days. And we'll take a look at the news headlines after this word from Coke.